Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what do the normalization agreements between Arab countries and Israel mean for security in the region and for the future of the Palestinian people? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On August 13th, 2020, the United Arab Emirates and Israel signed a peace agreement normalizing relations. Then on September the 11th, Bahrain joined the agreement. These are called the Abraham Accords, a biblical reference intended to link Islam and Judaism religiously as a foundation of the agreements. This has also led to a normalization or a drive to normalization of relations with other countries, including Sudan. This was formalized in January of 2021, and conversations with Morocco about a willingness to normalize relations with Israel in exchange for an American recognition of the nation's claims in Western Sahara. On today's show, we will discuss these developments and the implications for peace in the region, implications for the Palestinian people, and the domestic political implications throughout the Arab world, as well as in Israel, and also potentially the United States. Our guests are Larry Brandt, who is the Robert Branford Wright Professor of International Relations and Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Citizens Abroad, States and Migration in the Middle East and North Africa, and Official Stories, Politics and National Narratives in Egypt and Algeria. Mira Sukharov, who is the Professor of Political Science and University Chair of Teaching Innovation at Carleton University. She's the author of Borders and Belonging, a memoir, and co-editor of Social Justice in Israel-Palestine, Foundational and Contemporary Debates. And Hamoud Salih, who is professor of political science and Middle East and the associate dean of the College of Social and Natural Sciences at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He is a political commentator for Arab media. Larry Brandt, let's start with you. Could you give us a description of the agreements and what sort of led to these agreements earlier or last year?
Perhaps the best way to look at these agreements is to understand them in part as a logical consequence of trends that were already underway. These were hailed as peace accords, but in fact, none of the states that have signed these agreements, neither the original two, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, nor the Sudan, and then subsequently Morocco, were ever at war with Israel formally. And so these are better understood as normalization agreements or continuation of normalizations, because there were various forms of contact, communication, trade offices, and so on, which had been operating in some of these countries. Certainly in the UAE, there had been an office that had been operating between Israel and Morocco, which had been closed temporarily. So this has been reopened as part of that accord, but it's not, that's not new. So in that respect, these are continuations, perhaps deepenings of trends, relationships that were already in place. But I think that also needs to be seen in the context, of course, of what the Trump administration was doing, particularly what Jared Kushner, who was given the Middle East portfolio, along with, importantly, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, the kinds of things that they had been working on. And they, of course, had a very particular set of goals for what was happening in Israel-Palestine, and the goals focused on how to, I think, best achieve the best interests for Israel, which I suppose they saw as perhaps indistinguishable from U.S. interests, but certainly the Kushner family's longstanding interests in the West Bank. So I think that when we look at what the Trump administration was interested in doing in the region, again, we need to see it not in terms of somehow or other addressing the needs of both sides, but how to come up with some sort of a big splash show. I mean, that's the kinds of things that certainly appeal to Trump. And the idea of having Jared work on this sort of a peace program that was supposed to be the deal of the century, which of course is separate from these recent accords, the deal of the century, which was also very much tied up in the relationship between Trump and Netanyahu and in Israeli domestic politics, which perhaps Mira will talk about. in a few minutes. So the focus was on Israeli interests, Israeli and U.S. interests, to the extent the Trump administration saw them as coincident. And of course, any U.S. administration has may have a somewhat different view of exactly how those interests intersect. Trump, I think, was not particularly invested himself in anything other than seeing some kind of success that he could then use for two parts of his domestic constituency. And one of those would be the part of the American Jewish community that is very supportive of sort of the Netanyahu line when it comes to Israeli politics. But the other part, and in some ways, I think even much more important, it's been growing in importance, is the combination of sort of the Christian Zionist, the Christian fundamentalist, and even moving on to, I think, some, you know, white supremacist and white nationalist views, which understand the role of the state of Israel as fitting into their understanding of how they want to see politics either in the region or unfold in the United States. So I guess that's what I would say sort of as an opening, just brief survey. How the Palestinians react to this, of course, this has been negative, you know, across the board. I think it's also important to stress that while these negotiations or these accords of various sorts were touted highly by the leaderships of these countries, there certainly has been significant pushback from parts of the populations. We can't gauge exactly the degree of pushback because the UAE and Bahrain are two of the most repressive countries in the entire region. And so trying to figure out, you know, what gets expressed on social media there is in no way a guide to what average people think. But in any case, it has put the Palestinians, it's been a continuous process of further weakening their hand, further alienating them from more and more of their territory. And I also think just completely undermining any possibility of a two-state solution. But maybe we can talk about more of that later.
Mayor Sukharov, these agreements certainly have bolstered the political fortunes of Benjamin Netanyahu in Israeli politics. How important are they within the Israeli the political spectrum, and how are they playing sort of across the board within Israel?
Well, Bibi Netanyahu, as he well knows, is in deep hot water right now with the Israeli public. So the upcoming elections in March are going to be as much a referendum on whether the public, the Israeli public, wants his continued leadership than it is about particular policies. But there's no doubt that reaching these kinds of agreements will have helped the incumbent, which was Bibi. There was a poll soon after agreements were signed with the first two states you mentioned, UAE and Bahrain, and wide majorities of Israelis thought that the agreements would benefit Israel economically, politically, diplomatically, in terms of tourism. And then a smaller majority, but still over 50%, thought the deal will contribute positively to Israel's national security. So it's probably, I think, very safe to say, a political boon for the prime minister who managed to sign them, who was, of course, Bibi Netanyahu. Now, who are the major losers in the under Israeli rule? And in that case, I think it's quite fair to say that it's the Palestinians, because really what these agreements do is they, as Larry well articulated, it's not so much that there was active war between states and they've now signed a ceasefire and then a full peace treaty. They're simply normalizing relations. They're removing hostilities. Now, normalization in one sense is a wonderful thing. I mean, you want to recognize people in your midst, you want to see the other, you want to recognize each other's humanity. And I guess in a you know, scaling up to that in a state-to-state sense, the idea of collective recognition is a good thing for international relations, I would say, on its face. But remember that in the region, the idea of normalization has been used as a both a carrot and a kind of as a stick for rewarding or punishing Israeli actions vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And of course, that's where the controversy lies as to whether one agrees with Israel's approach to the Palestinians, then one would find lack of normalization cruel and unfair and maybe even bigoted. But if one believes that Israel should be pressured to end the occupation, free settlement building, extend fuller rights to Palestinians within its formal borders and within the West Bank, then the idea of withholding normalization can be an important bloodless symbolic tactic to affect change. So these are some of the dynamics I think that watchers are looking closely at.
And Hamad Saleh, I know that in the past, when states have moved towards normalization or in some cases, actually, you know, peace agreements with Israel, this has created fractures within the Arab world. And certainly the unity among Arab states and their policies vis-a-vis Israel has taken a hit as a result of these agreements. How are these agreements being received throughout the Arab world?
Well, first of all, it's really hard to speak of unity in the Arab world. The Arab system is really disintegrated, fragmented, and it's really divided along all the lines. Connected to that is the relegation of the Palestinian cause as the primary national drive for Arab politics that is now superseded by the conflicts in Libya, in Syria, and other places. This is to say, then, when this normalization was brought up, you could see that there are different approaches. Officially, the line is very clear, particularly in the case of the Gulf states. There was a sense that the narrative has changed and that the conflict that the Gulf countries come to see, or particularly how they see the Palestinian cause, this so-called new generation or the line of the narrative emphasizes the idea that this is part of the old. The young generation is interested in employment, in, you know, the new digital age. There is that narrative. Now, in the social media, it's a different case. There is the old Arab-Israeli conflict, very well pronounced. But what is very interesting is that when you look at each specific case, you'll see that in the case of the United Arab Emirates, there was a lot of emphasis on the national interest, on that this decision serves the national interest of the Emiratis. And the media and the general public made a big sort of statement that because the countries are not in peace, it didn't make sense. This is purely designed to serve the Emiratis' national interest. And we talk about the old, you know, language where there is already sort of rapprochement between the countries. This has just come out of the open. And then we've seen the case of both Sudan and the Bahrain. The media did not give a lot of importance to it. The Israelis, in fact, I think the defense minister was asked why there was no importance given to the treaty. He said, well, Bahrain is a small country, so we should not make a big deal out of it. So even the Israelis undermine it. And the Sudan is the same thing. There was a lot of emphasis on the idea that the Sudan get a break from the $330 million that they were supposed to pay for the families victim of the terrorist attack back in 1998. There was also other things, other benefits that the Sudanese were getting. But the case that got a lot of interest and it's getting a lot of sort of potential problems in the region is the cognition or the rapprochement between the Israelis and Morocco and its linkage to the Western Sahara. Now, when you look at the American position up to this point, it has been since 1979, some people could go that, or 2005, it has been supportive of the Western Sahara, the right to have self-determination. But the U.S. has been pushing for internal autonomy of the Western Sahara within the Morocco. So when the recognition or this rapprochement was linked to the Western Sahara, of course, it created huge problems. So the emphasis in the region has been on the reaction in the United States, particularly the opinion pieces that James Spica wrote, Jameson Hoffman in the Senate speech, and other articles that seems to underline and call for the U.S. administration to be cautious, and there are implications. The biggest concern in the region is instability, creating new conditions for a region to be in conflict, particularly within the Western Sahara, because the Polisario has already declared no longer respecting the ceasefire. So that creates problems with them. But in addition to that, the Morocco will get about $1 billion in arms purchases. Their military is very sophisticated. The United States has about 10 military bases in Morocco, sort of military bases called temporary places, in Libya, in Mali, and in Niger. So those places will create huge problems. In addition to the vast amount of money that is spent in Tunisia, where you have about $600 million spent on civil society, trying to bring this American democracy to Tunisia, and also the same in Morocco and Libya. Those efforts are seen with the United States taking sides specifically with Morocco in this case, especially if they push for it. And there are marks that could be sort of seen whether the current administration will change it. If that continues, the potential for creating sort of a dangerous situation is very high. What the Algerians and the scholars seem to agree is that it is best for the United States to separate the recognition of the Western Sahara with the normalization. And it could take concrete steps. One of the steps is the idea of not moving forward with the building or the construction of a consulate. Initially, back in October, in fact, was supposed to be built in Casablanca. This is an American embassy that is supposed sort of to a degree of an embassy that will serve the entire Northern Africa. That construction is now moved to inside the Western Sahara. So if the Biden administration is to stop that, that will be a sign that the region sort of will live with a neutral United States on the position, basically going back to the old Obama's position in particular. It's been very sort of tense. And everybody's waiting now. The region is waiting what President Joe Biden will do next.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the normalization agreements between several Arab countries and Israel with Lori Brandt of the University of Southern California, Mira Sukaroff of Carleton University, and Hamoud Sali of California State University at Dominguez Hills. Now, Lori Brandt, some issues that Hamoud had raised, certainly the role that the United States is playing in all of this, and in one constituency, certainly, it seems to be influenced by these normalization agreements are, you know, those who will profit from arms sales. I've heard certainly one of the descriptions of what's going on is that these in many ways are arms deals that enabling the U.S. to provide weapons to, you know, countries like UAE at a time when there's been some criticism of U.S. arms sales in places like Saudi Arabia because of the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. Is it fair to say ultimately, the American interest in this is this ability to sell arms and to be able to influence some of these different conflicts, like, say, Western Sahara, obviously, you know, Syria, Yemen.
You know, as Hamoud sort of made clear in his comments, I mean, different states have different reasons and they have different ways of benefiting from these normalization agreements. I think clearly with the UAE, there was the hope that having this normalization with Israel would remove an Israeli veto on future arms sales, or at least on some future arms sales. Because of course, I mean, the Israelis have made clear with the Americans, and the Americans I think have always honored this, that they will never sell to other countries weapons of a level of sophistication greater than what Israel already has. And so, and any kind of arms sales of any significant nature, I have always, you know, so I think raised suspicions in Israel before. With these normalization agreements, I think the belief was that this would reduce that. At this point, though, the Biden administration is reviewing the sale, the weapon, the aircraft sales to UAE. So it's not clear. I think a number of these things are going to be reviewed by the Biden administration. So there were some elements that I think were, again, sort of particular to the nature of Trump, his view of the world, the people that he had working with him. Now, you know, the desire to sell arms in the Middle East is not new. It certainly well predates this administration and others before it. So the desire for, you know, companies to take advantage of the huge market that exists for weapons of various sorts, I mean, that's not going to go away. And I don't expect that the lobbying for those sorts of things is going to diminish. What we'll have to see is what sorts of things these states want to buy and whether the fact that they have these normalization agreements with Israel is going to make a big difference on that front. Just in terms of, you know, with Sudan, there was, as Hamoud mentioned, there was, of course, the special deal that they got on the reparations that they were supposed to pay. But they also got taken off the terrorism list. And that was a huge part of what they wanted out of this. And with regard to Morocco, I think it's also important to mention, I mean, this is a violation of international law, what the U.S. did. And it's not the first time U.S. violates international law. I mean, the recognition of Israeli annexation of territories also is a violation and so on. So there are a number of elements in these last sets of agreements that are extremely problematic. The Biden administration is reviewing some, and it's not clear to me, for example, where the Biden administration is going to come down on what happened with regard to the recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara. But with regard to what the various policies toward Palestine or Palestinians themselves, I mean, there have been some, there clearly is going to be some pullback in some areas, but they're not going to move the embassy back to Tel Aviv. That's clearly going to stay there. There simply is going to be sort of, you know, a reinitiation of the aid to the PA, reinstating U.S. funding to UNRWA, also apparently reopening a mission in East Jerusalem. So, I mean, there will be some reversal of what the Trump administration was interested in doing, but not completely so.
Mayor Sukharov, as Larry Brandis pointed out, the Trump administration, it certainly isn't unique in their support for Israel, but had levels of support that were somewhat beyond what American positions have, you know, I typically been mentioning, for instance, the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem. How is the Israeli public and our political actors responding to the fact the U.S. has a new president? Are there concerns with these reviews? And how much of this is a partisan issue within Israel?
I think Israelis are always cautious when a new administration comes into place in Washington. And they, in many ways, the majority of Israelis were pleased with what they saw as Trump's very vocal support for the status quo and for entrenching Israel's hold on Jerusalem, for example. Of course, moving the embassy is a change to the status quo, but it means that it's reinforcing the existing relationship that the Israeli government has with the borders of Jerusalem. And their most recent memory of a democratic administration may indeed be when John Kerry, as Secretary of State, presided over a resolution that was very critical of Israeli settlements. And that was right at the end of the Obama term. And it's likely that many Israelis will be watching very cautiously to see what kind of critiques they receive. But remember that it was Obama that signed a massive 10-year aid deal to Israel, between the US and Israel. So I don't think there's any, there's certainly no rational basis for Israelis to think that the US under Biden will turn away from it.
And Hamoud Salih, again, you had referenced this shift. How much do you see the Biden administration continuing the Trump administration policies? And how much do you think these reviews might result in a new look at US Arab relations?
There are several reasons. The obvious one is that within, you know, political scientists or international relations will tell you that American foreign policy is characterized by its continuity. And when some differences happen, it doesn't, you know, touch the core. But what's very interesting is that it's really, as Laurie stated earlier, it varies from one state to another. But there are some issues that come about more. For example, the latest terrorist attack in Iraq, you have sort of an official, I think the prime minister, who said, we need help. And this is led by foreigners. That is by terrorists who are aligned with other countries. That's also an indication of the debate or the struggle that exists within the Iraqi system in terms of, you know, President Trump withdraw the troops. There are only 1,500 there. So whether Biden will come in and continue that withdrawal or not. So we know Biden also has an old position in that perspective, that he was known to have published an article or an opinion piece where he thought of Iran as better divided into three territories. So there is that debate there that exists within Iran, and this is surfacing. So whether Biden will follow Trump or not, I think it's still something to look at and to watch. I don't see as a major difference. I think where we are, where the focus is centered at this point, particularly in the Gulf region, is Iran. What will Biden do with this idea that he wants to go back to negotiation? The current position is, you could take it as a stated position, and if you follow Joe Biden, you could see it's part of that strategy, start with a big idea, and then everything is negotiating. The fact that he's calling for inclusion of a negotiation over the ballistic, missiles, is a non-starter. The Iranians see this, their defense, a part of their defense system. And it's an issue that was there for a long time. The United States took under Kerry and Clinton administration and Obama many years to reach an agreement where the Iranian felt safe. And that was one way for them to have some kind of defense system against the region. So the discussion there, everybody is watching it. The Emirati, of course, have a major concern, major what I call a really psychological threat. It's very interesting. I mean, Dubai has huge economic interest with Iran every time. But the political debate is also very interesting in the region. The security, UAE feel threatened by Iran. The same thing with the Saudis. So you have that security there where the United States, or Joe Biden particularly, is watched. Remember that Trump was very liked by the region. You know, he brought a lot to the region. In Northern Africa, I think it's mixed. There is that perception that the region, particularly in the Maghreb, they want that business deal. They want Trump to have economic aid. And the fact that, you know, there was on the table agreements that Tunisia was trying to get, sort of free zone agreement, or what you call it, free trade agreement with the United States. Also, there was security agreement. Algerians are interested in economic investment. There is about $1 billion that Trump was promising to invest in the region. So that economic or that transactional think that Trump has appealed to the region. But the security issues, the latest normalization with Israel really changed that. So Biden now is expected to reverse that. And again, it varies from one state to another. The Moroccan definitely don't want a reversal. They want to pursue that. Well, the Algerians are pushing in that direction. And what's very, very interesting in the debate in the region, just before the end of the Trump administration, there was a delegation from the State Department, AFRICOM, and I believe Defense, that visited the region. I think it went to Jordan, and then Algeria and Morocco. Well, out of the blue, one of the officials made a statement that the United States is not interested in building a military base in Western Sahara territory. Nobody was talking in the Algerian about building military base, where they were talking specifically about the removal of the recognition of the Western Sahara. That's the issue. But it tells you how dynamic is the region and how the perception vary from one area. But overall, there is more optimism about Joe Biden in the Northern Africa than in the Gulf region or the other part of the region.
When we come back, are Palestinians victims of the Abraham Accords? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How are the Abraham Accords, the agreements between Arab states and Israel to normalize relations, affecting the Palestinian people? What are the solutions to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? What are alternatives to a two-state solution? Should the focus for Palestinians be on civil rights? Doug Becker explores this and more.
I'm Doug Becker. What do these agreements mean for the future of the Palestinian people? We're discussing this issue with Larry Brandt of the University of Southern California, Mira Sukaroff of Carleton University, and Hamoud Sali of California State University at Dominguez Hills. So, Larry Brandt, when I heard of these normalization deals, the first thing that came to mind with me was the impact this had on the Palestinian population, that at least officially Arab countries have been resistant to normalize relations or strike peace agreements with Israel without some settlement of the Palestinian issue, Palestinian statehood, two-state solution, et cetera. There's been no reference to the Palestinians in these normalization regimes. It seems fairly obvious to me the Palestinians are one of the big losers in these agreements. What does this mean for Palestinian statehood or some resolution that gives Palestinians sovereignty and some degree of justice?
The Palestinians are big losers. I mean, they've been in the process of losing for decades. I guess I would say that the coming of the Trump administration should have been a signal that things would probably get worse, even in terms of sort of symbolic things. But also that, I mean, on the ground, you have just the continual, gradual but ongoing dispossession, continuing, expropriation of land, and then all of the things that go along with that. I mean, we had just recently the Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, which used the word apartheid for the first time in describing the conditions in which Palestinians live. Obviously, some people have called for the use of that before, but I think it highlights the situation that Palestinians find themselves in now, which is that while the Oslo Accords in the early 90s seemed to promise the possibility of the emergence of an independent Palestinian state, I mean, that was the way the Palestinians understood the end terms, not seemingly the way that that the Israelis did. But I guess, I mean, Edward Said, who was an early critic of Oslo, seemed to have understood earlier than a lot of other people that what this ultimately was going to mean on the ground was a gradual, yes, you have a Palestinian administration, the PA, which exercises sort of less and less authority over less and less territory. And the only significant authority that it really seems to exercise is security coordination authority with the Israelis. So to further further entrap Palestinians in what's already an extremely coercive, repressive situation. So we have, it almost seems like with the Trump administration, we have almost the closing of the book, if you will. I mean, if people have been talking for a long time about the two-state solution being dead, and a lot of people were resistant to that for a variety of reasons. People resistant, those who wanted to see an independent Palestinian state, who thought that sort of sovereignty was something that Palestinians were entitled to. But also for those who wanted to see an end to this conflict in which the Jewish character of the State of Israel would not be ultimately called into question. So as long as you have a two-state solution, you can continue to maintain that, okay, you can have one Jewish state and then you have this Palestinian state, and Jews can exercise their right to self-determination in the Jewish state and Palestinians in their Palestinian state. As you continue to foreclose the possibilities for anything meaningful in terms of Palestinian sovereignty, and I would say that that's basically completely foreclosed at this point, then what's left? You can either sort of continue to work on the fiction. I mean, Palestinians now are talking about having elections at the end of this year. And there's supposed to be a meeting in Egypt, the umpteenth iteration of a meeting to try and bring about some sort of Palestinian reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. And the way that the Palestinians got to this sort of impasse themselves is another ugly story of you know, betrayal and coordination, security coordination among the U.S., Israel, Jordan, Egypt, and so on. But that's another story. So increasingly Palestinians are talking about the fact that they're at this stage, it doesn't mean ultimate renunciation, God knows, you know, in the future what happens, but that there is no, there's very little likelihood of any kind of a meaningful sovereignty for Palestinians. And so therefore the place that the struggle needs to focus is now for civil rights for Palestinians, both in increasing rights for Palestinians in Israel, but also rights for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And that doesn't mean just the kinds of gestures which have been part of a series of suggestions about peace accords, where you know, if you can provide Palestinians with some sort of economic possibilities, that will, you know, that will somehow allay their or lead them to set aside their concerns. No, this is talking about a drive for full rights as in the framework of a one-state solution. So I think, you know, increasingly I'm reading and seeing these kinds of, hearing these kinds of discussions among Palestinians. I think they're going to become more prominent because nothing the Biden administration is going to do. I mean, they say that now they're resurrecting this two-state solution, but it's, anyway, I mean, I think that, you know, the time seems to have passed, at least at this point in history. And so now the emphasis really needs to be on the struggle for civil, political, human rights.
It's a really important point, the idea that we've moved so far away from a two-state solution, the emphasis should be on advocating for the civil rights of Palestinians. Mayor Sukharov, I know that's been a significant challenge, international debate, certainly domestic debate within Israel, about the ball sort of being moved further and further away from a recognition of Israeli responsibility for the Palestinian community, both within pre-1967 Israel and in the territories. In particular, one story that I'd love to have you comment on is this question about how successful Israel has been with vaccinations for COVID, but the Palestinian community completely outside of that, the seeming lack of interest and a sense of responsibility to the Palestinian population. What ultimately is the status of that, and where is that going?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with Laurie's analysis about Israel's relationship with the Palestinians and the need to push for civil rights now. Now, of course, the major challenge is that Israel has very strong narratives and ways of framing the issue that punts the question of whether Israelis are responsible for granting Palestinian rights or whether the fault lies with Palestinian leadership. So Laurie mentioned the possibility of reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas, and Israelis will be, well, the Israeli government, Israeli establishment, though, now, of course, not all Israelis think alike, but talking about those with primary, those whose views are primarily reflected in the current parliament. And that's what I'm talking about when I say Israelis, just as a shorthand. Israelis will say that the fact that Palestinians are way many years overdue for elections means that they are fundamentally, not necessarily in a racist way about Palestinian character, but that the Palestinian political system as it exists currently is fundamentally corrupt and problematic. And so Israelis are able to then say that, the Palestinian Authority needs to get its house in order before we deal with it. Israelis, of course, will be more likely to call the occupied territories disputed territories to show that this is part of an ongoing conflict that just hasn't yet been resolved. Even the idea of occupation is controversial in some Israeli circles. So there's certainly, and Israel will say that they did end the occupation in Gaza and look what they were rewarded with, Hamas missiles. Of course, that isn't seeing the full story either, because while Israel did pull its ground troops out of Gaza and its settlers in 2005, they soon after, once Hamas took over, they have maintained, along with Egypt, air ground control along with Egypt, and then in addition, airspace control, naval control, and control over the population registry. So Israel does maintain a significant hold over the Gaza Strip, and that's something that many Israelis don't want to acknowledge. You asked about vaccination. Yes, there are Israeli human rights organizations calling for Israel to abide by its obligations under international law as the occupying power, such that Israel as the occupying power is responsible for facilitating to the best of its ability in consultation and in accordance with the governing authority, with the Palestinian Authority, to facilitate vaccinations of Palestinians. That isn't happening to the degree that it should be. So that's, of course, something that human rights watchers are watching closely.
And I'm going to tell me, first of all, I'd love your reaction to the idea that really the focus should be on civil rights for the Palestinians. And ultimately, how important is the Palestinian issue in the calculations of other Arab leaders? Or have they kind of washed their hands of it and decided they want to move on to other issues?
You have among the people, and again, it varies from one region to another. Among the people, there is a strong support for the Palestinians. And you find this in the whole historical narrative there. You also have it in sermons on Fridays about the support of the Palestinians and all the debates that you have there. But at the official level or the media, the region has been more preoccupied with this civil war. You know, you have the Arab Spring, you have the wars in Libya, Yemen. The states have become more interested in their sort of national interests more than anything else. The fear that I am going to be next to be overthrown by a popular mass or another revision of Egypt or Tunisia has sort of made the states more focused on their national interests. Why is this important? In the past, when you have the official media outside there promoting the Palestinian cause, even if it's a half-hearted, but it gets the national news, it's reported about. So the core issue remains very important. And there is a sense that there is a division there between those who are opposing the normalization, which is really a few countries. But at the top of that list is the Algerians, who can, before the United Nations General Assembly back in September or after that, where the president basically said that he doesn't believe in normalization and the Palestinian rights are the first priority. That got a lot of social media, a lot of reaction, and the Algerians were praised for that. But what's happening is that normalization is a fait accompli. There is no going back to it. The degree of how this would happen, there is a huge conversation now that it tells that the Israelis are already doing treaties with the Arab world. The only thing is now it's in the open. But I think there will be some kind of revival under Biden with the old concept of the MENA region summit meetings. Remember, this is the idea that was created to integrate Israel and the Arab world, and that's supposed to be going along the peace negotiation that was happening with Oslo. That idea was killed in 1997, I think after the third or the fourth summit, when Netanyahu came to power, and what was supposed to be a summit at the national level became really a conference. What's very interesting at that conference is that Netanyahu was very clear that he really didn't want to have economic relations with the Arab world. He wanted to strengthen Israel's relationship with the Europeans. And specifically what he said is that the Arabs are too backward, too awkward, less developed. They have nothing to give to Israel except labor. And he was thinking about technology. At the time, you know, Israel is very advanced in information technology. And he didn't think that the Arab world has that. So he was against it. Of course, there are reasons for this. There is a political contest. But the point is that in the current Israeli sort of political structure, that MENA region, that MENA idea, will it see light? Will it be pursued? I think Biden will push for that, just to sort of create a sort of a balance between showing that he's interested in the integration of Israel in the Arab world, and that will satisfy perhaps the Israeli lobby and other pressure, but it also be in line with what the Arab world has been doing, and sort of it fits well with the idea of bringing peace to the region. Supposedly, the Palestinian cause will benefit from this, that there will be some kind of help, economic help. We've seen sort of the conference that Kushner did in Bahrain, all of that. But in the end, the Palestinian issue is really a reflection of what's happening of the Arab world system. I mean, the Arab world is in crisis. Even the debate, when you hear it, it's no longer about Arab solidarity or anything of the sort. I mean, we have scholars who come and quotes or imams who quote the Quran to say, you know, Israel should exist. I mean, that's no way you could see that that from religious leaders. So the dynamic changes. And, you know, the Palestinians also did not make it easier on them. The internal struggle that we've seen all these years have sort of legitimized the Arab or give credence to the Arab world leaders to sort of shy away from it. And a good example is the United Arab Emirates relationships to the Palestinians. I mean, the United Arab Emirates has cut ties back, and I think it's since 2014. And now at this point, when they normalize the relation with Israel and settlement was one an issue, the Palestinian leadership could not understand it. They wanted perhaps the UAE to live up to its sort of support by deed rather than word. So a last point, I think one of the concerns of the Palestinians at this point, and you find this in the Arab world, is that there is more emphasis on the international legitimacy on the Palestinian cause. Hanan Ashrawi said it, I think 2 or 3 years ago, when she said that we need to minimize the damage that the Israelis are causing to the Palestinian cause. And one way is to hold on to the international law. The Oslo Agreement, Dennis Ross in particular, tried to shift to take away that international legitimacy by creating Oslo to supersede the international law. So the agreements that are signed by the Israelis and the Palestinians, let's say rights of the refugees, whatever issue, even though it may be against principle of international law, but as long as the two countries agree on it, that sort of is legitimate enough. And that's really where the discussion issues. I think the Palestinians, that's where they're focused on. And the fact that the Palestinians are a member of the International Court of Justice, that also helps make their case.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. We're discussing the future of the Palestinians in light of the normalization agreements between several Arab countries and Israel. Lori Brand, my understanding of the Kushner plan for peace was in essence delinking the political factors, whether it be statehood, even certain legal obligations to the Palestinians, in exchange of a promise for investment, kind of using investment as a way to try to depoliticize this question. First, how accurate is that description? And secondly, does that hold any promise towards some resolution to this issue?
I think that's a good way to sort of briefly summarize it. And the answer is no. It's part of what I was referring to earlier, that this is sort of a reiteration, if in somewhat, you know, different form, of earlier suggestions that if you can just provide the Palestinians with some kind of economic relief, then they'll somehow or other give up their national aspirations. It didn't work before, and it's not going to work now. What the Trump administration managed to do was, to a certain extent, sideline the Palestinians, but also increasingly crush them. Through refusal to, I mean, the cutting of aid to UNRWA is sort of, for me, almost in the same category as taking kids from their parents at the border. I mean, this is funding that goes to basic human services like healthcare and education and food, support to some of the poorest Palestinians. And it's important, I think, also, I know we're getting close to the end of time here. I don't want to be left out of the discussion. The Palestinians who are not in either, you know, present day Israel or the West Bank and Gaza, mm-hmm. There are, you know, large refugee populations. And while many Palestinians have, you know, become part of our diaspora and they become successful and they moved elsewhere, there are still large, extremely vulnerable, both economically, politically, and certainly now medically, in health terms, communities in Lebanon, in Syria, who've been terribly affected by the Syrian civil war, and now the dreadful crisis that's in Lebanon. These people are still there. These people still were promised a right to return by UN resolutions, and they can't just be sort of imagined away from some sort of a long-term solution. So I would just say, I mean, Jared Kushner, again, he knew nothing except what he wanted. And this the idea that holding out some sort of economic incentives was somehow a great new idea that constituting a deal of the century just was an indication of his ignorance, but also his lack of real concern. I mean, this was, again, a sidelining or a crushing, a combination of Palestinians under the Trump administration. And that's why it seems to me that the people who are talking about a one-state solution, because the territorial ability that Palestinians to have some sort of a sovereign entity now seems to have been gradually, gradually taken away from them by the Israelis, but also with the Trump administration recognizing settlements. It seems to me that the next phase in the struggle is for full rights in what would be a binational state.
And Mira Sukharov, Larry Brand really kind of highlights one of the real challenges Israel faces here, that if there's a one state solution, there's a very large Palestinian community currently within that one state, and of course, large refugee populations. How does Israel, and in particular, I know your research on narratives on the founding of the state of Israel and the definition of the state of Israel, how does Israel manage this large Palestinian community that would be within one state? I would imagine they wouldn't want ethnic cleansing or, you know, driving populations out of this state. And so what Larry Brand is advocating for is some sort of binational state with full civil rights. And I would imagine the right to vote, the right to politically organize would have to be included in that. What does that mean for the Israeli state?
Well, right now there is what Ian Lustig in his new book, Paradigm Lost, calls the one state reality. So that instead of saying that we have a blank slate and should we consider a one state solution or a two state solution, we take what Laurie was saying earlier about the two state solution really being dead for all intents and purposes, as far as we can see things, and say that there is this one state reality. So either we continue to enable Israelis to continue ruling over the existing Palestinians within those existing borders from the river to the sea in an unequal way with lack of basic rights, or we outsiders put some sort of pressure on Israel to extend rights. And so, of course, Israel doesn't want to, right? There's every incentive for, in a sort of basic materialist rational sense, there's every incentive for Israel to continue the status quo. They're not losing that much. So it's a matter of enabling those organizations and citizens within Israel who are pushing for change to bolster them and helping them see a new possible reality where identity, where Israeli Jewish identity is still nurtured and supported through new rights-based arrangements.
When you say rights-based arrangements, I want to follow this up. Is that include the right to vote, the right to politically organize? And what does that mean for the Jewish character of the state?
Well, it would absolutely have to include the right to vote, and every other democratic right extended to Israeli citizens currently would have to be extended to all the Palestinians who live between, who live in Israel proper and who live in the West Bank, and Gaza we could discuss separately, but there are many similarities in some ways to the situation in the West Bank. And then instead of Israeli Jews thinking about their identity in collective terms as defined by demographics, they would be thinking about their identity as a cultural inheritance, so that it doesn't matter how many Jews there are relative to how many Palestinians there are. It matters, we could say, how many Hebrew films are produced each year, how many works of Hebrew literature are produced, how much new thinking about Jewish texts are created. And so that you start thinking about culture as something that can be grown, and then you sort of start expanding the pie alongside Arabic culture and alongside Palestinian culture and the Muslim and Christian variants of that as they're expressed in Palestinian society.
fascinating, this way in which to reframe these questions. So I'll ask Hamoud Salih, this will be the last question as far as reframing the contemporary conditions and the ways in which we've been viewing this conflict. Do you have ideas that we can try to reframe this in a way that might make it potentially resolvable in a way that's not just rejecting the rights, the political personhood of the Palestinians?
One is tempted to say that you have, for the Palestinians, one of the most well-educated, best-educated society in the entire Middle East by the number of doctors and all of that. So one narrative could be is that the Palestinians sort of, when they want, somehow, their cause will be sort of recognized and their rights will be recognized. And that's sort of the optimistic, the idealistic. The reality is that there is so much talk about the narrative, the negotiation for the sake of negotiations. There is also the facts on the ground that Israel has become a very strong entity militarily, that the Israeli society also feels safe, that the left or the organization that once were strong advocate of the Palestinian cause are missing in action, all of that. So there is that narrative of the crisis. Maybe you could say the left, but it's also of the people who are advocating for a just solution to the Palestinians. So I really don't know how to look at it, except that it's a crisis of the Palestinians' leadership that is also a reflection of the crisis that is happening in the Arab world. And a solution to the Palestinian cause is, of course, from internal, because you have to fight for that right. If a civil rights movement would be one thing, like Edward Said was pushing for, if a one-state solution will be within, it has to be from within. But without the support also of the outside partners, the Arab world and allies, the Palestinians may be lost in that struggle as well.
Thank you all very much. We've been discussing the normalization agreements between Arab countries and Israel, the implications for the Palestinians, the implications for the Arab world, and finally, a call to reconceptualize the conflict in ways that could be much more supportive of full political participation and representation of all peoples within the region. Our guests today have been Larry Brand, the Robert Brand Granford Wright Professor of International Relations and Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California. She is the author of Citizens Abroad, States and Migration in the Middle East and North Africa, and Official Stories, Politics and National Narratives in Egypt and Algeria. Mira Sukharov, who is Professor of Political Science and the University Chair of Teaching Innovation at Carleton University. She's the author of Borders and Belonging, a memoir, and co-editor of Social Justice and Israel-Palestine, Foundational and Contemporary Debates. And Hamoud Salih, Professor of Political Science and Middle East Studies, Associate Dean of the College of Social and Natural Sciences at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He is a political commentator for Arab Media. Thank you all very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
هو الصحراويين اللي عندهم ماشي عندهم لا القضية الصحراوية هاي المسيرة اللي عادلها أكثر من 40 سنة الناس